general government subcommittees and Ways and Means. This morning we have representing us from Legislative Fiscal Office, Adrian Sexton, and our assistant today is Karen Segrist, subcommittee assistant. So we are scheduled for a public hearing on Senate Bill 5522, GSPC, Government Standards and Practices. Did that cost me?
Yes.
Okay. All right. There's the piggy bank. Acronyms are 25 cents a piece, and I just bought Government Standards and Practices Commission, GSPC. So that's two, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I bought it. It belongs to me.
I believe that was a definition.
Oh. My committee, when you define, you get fined.
Oh, okay. Well, you've got a lot of acronyms in your committee, Senator. You've got acronyms that go on for a page, so I appreciate that. With that, we'll go ahead this morning, Senator Winters, I guess for the record, we probably ought to make sure that we excuse Senator Devlin. He'll be a few minutes late until 9 o'clock, I understand. Representative Patridge and Representative Johnson both have other commitments outside the present committee for a few minutes at least, and may be joining us. We may also address other ways that we may be changing the format that we start hearing some of these on a more accelerated basis after we've met with our co-chairs a little bit later today. With that, Adrian, perhaps you'd like to lead off on behalf of Legislative Fiscal Office on Senate Bill 5522.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Winters. I will be brief. Much of the information that I have in my presentation is redundant, but I'll just summarize basically that the Oregon Government Standards and Practices Commission is an agency that was established as a result of a vote of the people, and the agency's responsibilities are to regulate ethics of Oregon public officials, which is a very large body of individuals across the state, to regulate lobby activities, and to enforce the Oregon public meetings laws as it relates to executive sessions. The agency also prepares and presents education for public officials and lobbyists as a means of being proactive and advising so that they public officials understand what the requirements are, and lobbyists as well. And then they also prepare and distribute an ethics manual, and that is a requirement based in statute. The governor's excuse me, my second page, I have 2001-03 Governor's Recommended Budget. That's not it. It's 2003-05. $620,337 all funds, of which $613,722, or 99%, is general fund. The other fund portion comes from sale of publications and so forth, but because of the high use of the internet now to distribute documents, that amount has gone down over time. The third page that I have in here is a representation of the agency's actual expenditures from 1991 through 2001. You'll note also that the FTE allocation is in there and has gone from a high of 6.25 down to the current FTE level, authorized level of 4 FTE. However, the current staffing level is not at that height, and the agency will discuss that more. General budget drivers of this agency, really, it's an external thing. It's based on the number of complaints that the agency receives, and then those that they determine to be within the agency jurisdiction, but they do have to look at all that they receive. They also get a number of requests for information from public officials and the public, and lobbyists as well, and numbers of requests for advisory opinions. Those advisory opinions may be developed by either the staff with the approval of the commission, or the commission may officially issue one. They also make a number of education presentations. Again, that is a statutory responsibility.
I'm sorry, what was that?
The number of education presentations made. and then finally, the budget is also driven by the due process options that are available to respondents in cases.
What does that mean in layman's talk?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, that would be the opportunities that a respondent has to, as the course of a case goes along, to opt for having the matter settled in court rather than being reached at a decision or a determination based on discussion between the respondent and the commission.
Okay. They have that responsibility to...
They have that opportunity to take it to court if they so choose.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And then that does then develop the additional expenditure requirements on the part of the agency.
I appreciated an earlier visit from Dave Moss, one of the members of the commission, and Dave tells me I haven't ever been investigated by the Government Standards and Practices Commission. I appreciate your letting me know that, Dave. I was concerned that I was under investigation or had been under investigation. Those of us who have a...
If you're wearing that beef hat.
Somewhat dark past. That's right. If you can't say it in cowboy, then... Okay. With that, let's see. This morning we will have...
Mr. Chair, if I might just draw your attention to two more items.
You're going to go into the budget. Okay.
Yeah. I have the Legislative Fiscal Office analysis of the Governor's 2003-05 budget, which does show that the total funds that they have budgeted in here is $620,337 with three FTE. So that would be dropping the number of positions in order to maintain a minimal level of a viable agency with all of its capacity in terms of the program responsibilities, not the capacity that they have today to meet those obligations. Generally, the budget environment, because they are principally a general funded agency, they have experienced a series of budget reductions through the special session activities. They've also experienced an increase in the Attorney General and other fees and charges that have been associated with a small number of major cases or cases in which the respondent chose to take the matters to court rather than settling out of court with the commission. Those few cases then did result in the award of prevailing party fees. The agency then came to the emergency board, and that's the last item in my packet, with three requests for additional general fund appropriation allocation from the emergency fund. The first one was in November of 2001, and that was a total of $93,500, and that was relative to a case against three public officials. The total included interest on the attorney fees, and the commission didn't appeal that one to the circuit court, didn't appeal the circuit court ruling. In April of 2002, there was a total allocation of $102,000 from the emergency fund. Again, that was for a prevailing party awards and the associated unanticipated attorney general legal fees. Just a reminder that the agency's budget never includes funds for extraordinary charges because they are so variable. So they're base budget, their core budget includes attorney general costs for their ordinary normal activities, so that for the collaboration with the attorney general's office during the course of their regular commission meetings and those types of activities, but none for particular cases. That is then the understanding that they come to the emergency board for those costs as needed. The third request was in November of 2002, where we allocated Mr. Chair, my apologies. I think the total was not. The request was for $106,360. We actually allocated $89,818, and that was included an unscheduling of $30,000 for attorney general fees until billings were actually received for those, because the amount was expected to go out over the duration of the biennium. I just would like to also note for the record that during the course of that discussion in the emergency board. The Legislative Fiscal Office analysis also noted that no policy review of this agency had occurred since 1991, 1993, and that the course of events since that time might warrant a substantive policy examination by this assembly in order to help educate or inform the budget process if some policy decisions were made that might affect the agency's operations, responsibilities, duties, roles, and so forth, that might then influence the budget process. There are bills now in the Senate General Government Committee that do talk to the Commission's responsibilities. One of them includes an assessment on public officials required to file statements of economic interest, basically it as well as all public officials. So it would be to each jurisdiction, state government, local governments, the special districts, all of those who fall under this very broad category of Oregon public official.
How much is that?
The amount in the measure is no less than $2 and no more than $5 per public official.
So my folks from the South Board of Control down in Southern Niagara County, when they file and win an election on that board, which you don't file and win, you're assigned to the
right.
board, basically, then those folks would each pay somewhere between $2 and $5 to be have that opportunity to be members of that board. Then.
That's my understanding. The mechanism for how that assessment would be administered is not part of the bill, so that would be something to consider when that happens. And at least one of those bills, and I was going to check on the second one this morning and did not, has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, so they could come here and be part of that discussion. So that was the last thing I wanted to get on the record for your benefit. I am done.
Well, thank you very much. We appreciate it. And let's see. It shows that the Government Standards and Practices Commission is represented by Dave Moss, Chair, Carl Vistainer, Member, and Pat Hearn, Executive Director, with Budget and Management Division Analyst Laurie Byerly. So, why don't you folks just go ahead. And the piggy bank is for the... Laurie knows what it's for. It's for the American Red Cross. Or no, American Cancer Society. I beg your pardon. Red Cross is one of the other ones that gets our money. So please proceed. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'm Pat Hearn, Executive Director of the Government Standards and Practices Commission. And as you indicated, also with us today are the Chair of the Commission, Dave Moss, and Member of the Commission, Carl Vizentin. And I appreciate them taking the time to come over this morning. My review is going to be also brief, as Ms. Sexton's was, and there may be a little bit of redundancy, but I also hope that I'll be able to elaborate somewhat on some of the points that she brought up. As has been indicated, the commission was created as a result of a vote of the people in 1974. Actually, the legislation had been passed unanimously in both houses during the 1973 Legislative Assembly. But Governor McCaul vetoed the bill because he did not like the statement of economic interest disclosure requirement in the bill. So the Assembly came back to Salem for a special session in January of 1974, and they took the matter up again, passed it as a referral, and it won in the November election by a margin of 71%. Part of that same bill, which was called the Ethics in Government Act, was lobbying regulation. So those were the two first areas of commission jurisdiction, and actually the initial name of the agency was the Oregon Government Ethics Commission, and the chapter of law, ORS Chapter 244, is entitled Government Ethics. That was changed 10 years ago during the 93 Assembly to Government Standards and Practices. The commission is comprised of seven citizen members with a rather unique appointment process. Four of the seven members are appointed by the legislative leadership. The Senate and Democratic leaders in each house appoint one member to the commission. The remaining three are appointed directly by the governor. there can be no more than four members serving at any one time who belong to either of the two major political parties, and of the three that are directly appointed by the governor, not more than two may belong to either of the two major political parties. Their term of service is limited to a single four-year term in a lifetime, unless they're appointed to fill an unexpired term of 3 years or less, at which time they may be reappointed to serve a full four-year term. Since 1995, the agency staff has consisted of 4.0 FTE, an executive director, two investigators, and an executive support specialist. Last November 1st, that was reduced to 3.0 FTE because of the current budget situation facing state government. And March 1st, that 3.0 was further reduced to 2.42, which is where we are now. The executive assistant and myself have gone to 80% time, and our investigators, out of what was 80 hours of investigator time a week, is now 33 hours of investigator time a week. And while I'm on the staff thing, I'd just like to mention a couple of things that I found myself to be very interesting and I wanted to share with you. It was my intent on November the 1st for the investigators to be laid off because of the cuts that have occurred as a result of special sessions and et cetera, and the short four-month window left to the end of the biennium. It appeared as though that would be about the only way we could achieve end-of-the-year expenditures within the reduced budget. But I was surprised to learn a couple of things. One was that state agencies are required to pay full unemployment benefits because, unlike private business, we don't pay unemployment tax. So if we have an employee who is laid off, we have to pay their full sum. I had one investigator who was eligible for maximum unemployment benefits, plus he had about 150 hours of accrued vacation. Had we laid him off March the 1st, paid his unused vacation time and his unemployment for 4 months, it would have cost more during the 4 months of the biennium than it was to keep him on. The second investigator was not eligible for full unemployment benefits. He was eligible for partial benefits, and he was also going to be laid off March the 1st. It was calculated that his unemployment benefit would be about $1,105 a month. So he came to me with a proposal that rather than him sit at home and do nothing and have us pay his unemployment of $1,105, he would come back to work and work whatever number of hours would equate to that in a month. So in that situation, he's working 13 hours a week, and we're paying $20 a month more than we would if he was on unemployment. So I found those to be interesting. The executive assistant in the office has accrued maximum vacation time and some unpaid compensatory time. And were she to have been laid off or furloughed for the remainder of the biennium, the payout to her would have been probably 4 or 5 months the equivalent of her salary to pay. So when we get down to short windows like this, we have to look at a lot of variables, and this was a real enlightening experience for me.
Let me just ask some questions about that. We may just vary from the standard method by which we've gone through these, Mr. Hearn. So your policy for accrued vacation, is there a state policy or is that just by your department?
It's a state policy, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And the maximum accrued vacation is?
350 hours, sir, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And so you had folks with a lot of accrued vacation, 350 hours. That's a lot of time. That's 2 months, isn't it? Pretty close to 2 months?
Sure, yes, it is.
Okay. And once terminated, that's awarded to them immediately at that point.
Yes, Mr. Chair, it's paid.
And then in addition to the unemployment and accrued vacation, is there you talked about compensatory time?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. In this instance, the executive assistant is the only clerical support person we have, is often required during, for instance, the times of filings of statements of economic interest and lobbyist expenditure reports, et cetera, is required to work overtime. And she takes that in compensatory time as opposed to paid overtime.
Okay. And what's the policy with regard to maximum compensatory time?
Mr. Chair, there is no maximum. That's pretty much up to agency discretion.
So a person could have 2 or 3 years of compensatory time, potentially?
Mr. Chair, I would hope not. I would hope that there wouldn't be a manager that would permit that to happen.
I would hope not, too. How much compensatory time did this particular executive assistant have?
Mr. Chair, she has approximately 120 hours.
Okay. Well, that's, and that's all by, it'd be interesting to know because I would hope that in the process we would have some reserves for unemployment and make sure that we don't have anything booked that's, or fail to book these kinds of liabilities so that we can make administrative decisions when they need to be, but I appreciate you bringing that to our attention. I honestly haven't dealt with the policy relative to the amounts of vacation and accruals and so forth. And I don't think in all the 4 years that I've been here have I really ever sat down and gone through that. Senator Winters, you probably do that on a regular basis in your department.
Well, yes, and, you know, it did come up for discussion during one of our special sessions. I brought it up because when we were talking about, some of the salary packages and looking at reducing some of those, and I brought up the issue that when you do that, you have several factors. You have to pay for vacation. You have to pay for the compensatory time, and, you know, as well as you get into the whole issue of bumping and some of those other issues. And as a result, we could end up, it cost us more than it was if we actually had the package sitting there. So it is an area that, as policymakers, we really do need to be mindful of when we're talking about, you know, layoff or
and in fact, I think in special session and the rebalance, the final rebalance of 0305 or 0103, we did actually have some as opposed to any savings, we actually had to put money into some departments to buy out those issues. I assume that when we do that, and unemployment is involved, we put in, from a budgetary standpoint, we put in enough to cover the 4 months of unemployment, as you indicated, Mr. Hearn.
Well, that's what it would have been this by any means, Mr. Chair.
Okay. That's interesting that's an ongoing obligation. Thank you very much for that explanation. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The agency's primary goals are excellent customer service and prevention of violations, and accordingly, the existing performance measures in place focus on the length of time required for the commission to complete its preliminary review from the time a complaint is filed, then to complete investigations from the completion of preliminary review, issue advisory opinions, and the number of training sessions that are presented annually, as those go hand in glove with proactive prevention. We have analyzed our data for the years of the five-year period of 1988 through 2000, and we found that all performance measures have been met or exceeded. The Performance Review Committee found that that our performance measures met 4 out of 5 basic criteria. The one that was not met was a data sources sheet, which was inadvertently omitted from their initial review. However, that was submitted. They have offered us some suggestions that I think would be of great value in helping us to further define and refine what our performance measure should be, and we can intend to continue to work with the Progress Board in that regard. The agency's programs and services include the three areas of jurisdiction that Ms. Sexton earlier mentioned, but however, the primary one, the one that consumes most of our agency's time, is the enforcement of ORS Chapter 244, Government Standards and Practices Law. Now, Ms. Sexton referred to the Commission's broad jurisdiction, and I'd like to spend just a moment on that because I find that it is usually something that is not clearly seen in the big picture. The Commission has jurisdiction over all public officials of Oregon. Public officials are defined as anyone who serves the state of Oregon or any political subdivision of the state in any capacity, compensated or not. Well, mental exercise myself, I was amazed at the result. We look at the statewide elected officials, of course, the 90 members of the legislature, 45,000 state government employees, and then the elected officials, volunteers, board and commission members, employees, etc., of 36 counties, 238 cities, 199 school districts, and several hundred special districts. In recent months, as there's been media coverage about possible PERS reform, there's been some numbers in those stories about the number of current and retired PERS participants. And the last number I saw on the number of current active PERS participants was 189,000. Well, not all public officials in Oregon participate in PERS. Some, such as Portland, have their own retirement system. So I would say it would be a safe guess that the commission's jurisdiction extends to over 200,000 public officials in Oregon. Pretty amazing for such a small agency. But in regard to the enforcement of Chapter 244, as has been indicated, we give training presentations around the state.
That's mandated by statute.
The statute mandates that the commission shall prepare and present a program of continuing education for public officials and lobbyists. It doesn't get any more specific than that.
Is that available over the Internet at this particular point?
Mr. Chair, the training itself is really not available. The materials that are used in the training, information and so forth, certainly is.
But so that portion of the mandate could be met by continuing to publish the ethics manual and other material, as opposed to a distribution of it, of physical materials, could be distributed over the Internet, over the World Wide Web.
Mr. Chair, that's what we do now. Yeah,
okay.
That's exactly what we do now.
So all of that technically is met by the publication of that and the distribution over the Internet, then?
I suppose you could say that,
okay.
Yes.
Please proceed. I'm sorry.
That's all right. I'm trying to remember where I was going. I was going to try to make another point. As far as the constituencies for the training presentations, I'd just like to comment on that for a few minutes. It's the annual conventions of a lot of the large public official associations, such as the Association of Oregon Counties, the League of Oregon Cities, the Special Districts Association, Police Chiefs Association, Fire Chiefs Association, Fire District Directors, the School Law Conference. Virtually all of those professional associations. But in addition, we try to do regional training, such as having a county or a city coordinate and facilitate putting together a training session somewhere. As an example, this past fall I went down to Gold Beach, and Curry County volunteered to be responsible for putting together some training. And in an afternoon session one day and a morning session the next day, we had almost 200 people come in. And so that was a very worthwhile thing. Some of the conferences that we do, we address the General Assembly rather than breakout groups, and there's often 300 or more people.
Those are mostly public officials? You know,
yes, sir. Mr. Chair, they are. And, of course, we also hope when we're doing training of that type that there's a trickle-down effect, too, that these people are going to go back to their respective venues and they're going to share the information that they've heard with other managers and other employees and other public officials there.
Let me just ask a question relative to that. The Secretary of State's office is doing some training as well relative to responsibilities that folks have once they want to try and get their name in a voters brochure, and they do some work there. Is there some overlap of some of the training and supervision? I mean, even when I'd ask Mr. Moss, and I said, well, I think I've been nailed by the commission once myself, and he wrote me a kind letter to say, no, you've been nailed by another agency. Tell me about any overlap or potential for overlap, if you would, Mr.
Moss. Mr. Chair, I don't have any personal knowledge of what the Elections Division or the Secretary of State's training objectives are. I can say that I don't believe there's any overlap in any way because our jurisdictions are simply totally different.
I guess in this particular regard, and Dave knows the circumstances, I've been a public official for 10 years approximately, and an elected public official, and I just didn't know who it was that, you know, I mean, when you write a letter as a county commissioner and say, we don't think that this is very good for the economy of Oregon, and then, you know, somebody sends us a bill saying you shouldn't have written that letter, here's pay $25 and we'll expunge your name from, you know, having written that letter. The concern I've got is, I guess I didn't know who it was that I was offending by standing up for my county economic development. And I think Dave, go ahead and tell me what you found out, Dave. You've written me a note on it.
Mr. Chair, I'm Dave Moss, Chair of the Government Standards and Practices Commission. The Government Standards and Practices Commission does not in any way, shape, or form get engaged in election law. And that is entirely under the purview of the Secretary of State and the Elections Division of the Secretary of State. Our commission works with open meetings, executive sessions, lobby regulation and reporting, statements of economic interest of public officials, and ethics issues regarding public officials, that is, conversion of public money to private gain and what have you. The Secretary of State in the Elections Division oversees all election law, and that is the movement of people onto the ballot and through the voter's pamphlet.
So let me make sure I understand. I'm sorry this isn't clear. I just about have to say it in cowboy for me this morning. If somebody says that wants to get in the voter's pamphlet and says that they're a graduate of XYZ University and that they've been a president of X, Y, and Z, then that's not an ethical violation. That's a elections violation.
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct, because that would be part of the voter's pamphlet. And part of the process to get into the voter's pamphlet, you have to, as a candidate, you must swear that a certain information provided is true. Interestingly enough, page 2, you don't have to swear it's true. That's where you promise and things like that. But the background information on your education and your employment and what have you, you must sign that to your best of your knowledge it is true. And that is overseen by the Secretary of State's office. And is enforced and whatever by the Secretary of State. It may be ethically questionable to lie there, but it's not part of the ethics law that we oversee. It is strictly an election issue.
I see. So, and the instant issue dealt with the mining initiative, and
that's correct.
I guess my concern is there. I thought we'd violated some ethical. Yeah. Rule by encouraging other county commissions not to to jump in the middle of anti-mining operation initiative.
Mr. Chair, I think it's sort of a gray area that you got caught in, but I believe what happened, and I have not gone back and looked at the file. My record is
open now. I stand guilty as charged.
But there are issues. I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Dave. Finish, and then we'll go to Senator Devlin.
Because that dealt specifically with a ballot initiative, and my understanding there was an issue of when the letter occurred, either while the initiative was gaining signatures or after it qualified for the ballot. There's a difference, and I believe that. The letter in question came after it was qualified for the ballot, and so the letter was considered to be campaigning with public letter or public letterhead or whatever it may have been. I know $25 is not a small fine, but it's not a big fine, and it's a de minimis violation. I think that's what happened, but that is not part of what the Ethics Commission gets involved in.
I see. Okay. Senator Devlin, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman. I just thought I might try to shed a little bit of light on this. In my tenure here, I've spent two terms on the House Rules Committee, which is one of the aspects of the elections laws in the state, and two aspects of this. One, in terms of training, the only real training I've ever seen the Secretary of State do relative to candidates and political committees is they have always conducted periodic training for people in terms of understanding contribution and expenditure requirements and how to fill out reports and all of that. The second thing relates to the comments here regarding that. I don't know how long this has gone on, and I don't think it's a negative, but but a positive. But somehow the Secretary of State, at least since I've been here, has taken on a role of advising public officials on when it is appropriate to use public resources and when it is not appropriate to public resources. Actually, every time we get close to an election cycle here, the Secretary of State sends out some sort of letter that says, basically, understand that there are things that can be done publicly and there are things that have to be done with campaign dollars, and basically sort of like a warning to employees here that they have to keep that line pretty fine. The situation that's come up relative to measures, and I've been involved in this because I've endorsed many measures as an elected official in terms of like being a part of a public body, is they've gotten extremely strict in the sense that they want you not to utilize any public resources. Somebody from the commission or the board needs to prepare the resolution. The board can still vote on the resolution. I think they kind of just overlooked the fact that it's recorded. but actually, in a sense, just trying to make this a very strict line that of not utilizing public funds in support or opposition to a measure. Obviously, you can use public funds in support of a legislative agenda for a city or a county or a special district, but it is different from the role that the Board of Standards and Practices plays, but I think the Secretary of State over the years has expanded the role a little bit.
Appears so.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, if I could just draw one line, I think it might clarify a little bit. If the violation, because behavior is ethical or not in a lot of ways, if there is a personal gain involved, then the ethics law that we oversee would come into play. If there is no personal gain, but it has something to do with the election law, then that would be the Secretary of State. And I know in your case there was no personal gain at all, that you were doing public body or public official work.
I think, as I recall, there was a $25 levied against each member of the county commission and our economic development coordinator for the county for having sent out a letter encouraging folks. I think you're right. It dealt with the timing of when the actual initiative had enough signatures or didn't have enough signatures, and sometimes we don't always know that in rural parts of the state back then. So I appreciate that explanation, but I was trying to figure out where that fine line was. So thank you very much. You were continuing to talk about your constituency, Mr. Hearn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I was finished with the training. Moving on, just to quickly discuss the activities in lobbying regulation, executive sessions law. Lobbying regulation, we do give training, not nearly as much as we do in the government standards and practices area, but then there's not nearly as many lobbyists either. We're talking about 500 or 600 lobbyists as opposed to 200,000 public officials. So
you train those for a fee, is that correct?
No, sir, we don't charge.
You don't charge for training lobbyists?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
No.
Thank you.
Expenses only. In other words, if my agency incurs expenses for me to do that, then I ask that the agency be reimbursed for those expenses.
I think the $6,500 of other funds in this budget is mostly copying charges, I recall.
That's right.
Okay. Thank you.
So in addition to training, we register lobbyists, which by that act also registers the lobbyist entity. Lobbyist entities don't register separately, but when a lobbyist registers as representing someone, then they become a registered entity. So we receive their reports periodically. In fact, we're just getting ready in the next week to mail out lobbyist reports for the first quarter of this year, because during a session year, there's an extra filing for the period of January to March. So
that's managed by your office?
Yes, Mr. Chair. All lobbyists and lobbyist entity expenditure reporting is under the jurisdiction of our office.
And is it statutorily that they're not charged for their registration and their other than just direct costs?
Mr. Chair, I'll be happy to go there. It's down the page here a little bit on that.
Please
very,
go there now.
I will. I'll be happy to. In 1993, the Legislative Assembly enacted a lobbyist registration fee of $50. It was for a 2-year period. It did not apply to private persons coming down to lobby the assembly out of personal interest, but it applied to those who represent businesses or associations or private contract lobbyists, etc. Shortly after it went into effect in 1994, the American Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit in the Marion County Circuit Court alleging that the issue was unconstitutional because it violated Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution, which is a freedom of expression clause. It ended up going through the court system to the Court of Appeals and ultimately to the Oregon Supreme Court, which I believe in 1997 or 98, it took a long time, came down with a final ruling that the statute did in fact violate the Oregon Constitution, and accordingly there has been no lobbyist registration fee charged or collected since. It's interesting to note that in the legislation that enacted that registration fee, there was commentary to the fact that the revenue from that fee was to go toward defraying the expense of the commission preparing educational materials and conducting educational programs. And as an aside, Mr. Chair, I just received some information from a professional association I belong to, Council on Governmental Ethics Laws. And it was a survey of what states charge lobbyist registration fees. There's about 31 or 32 states now that charge lobbyist registration fees.
And the American Civil Liberties Union says that we can't in Oregon. With the Supreme Court.
Mr. Chair, the Supreme Court agreed with them, yes. In addition to the lobbyist registration fee of 1993, other program changes that have occurred in the past 10 years were that the 93 session also added the executive session provision of public meetings law to the commission's jurisdiction. And that's the only provision of public meetings law that has any enforcement mechanism. Kind of an interesting anomaly. There's meeting notice requirements. There's requirements that if you have more than three of a five-member body together and you discuss any official business, it's an illegal meeting. But yet the only remedy available to citizens for those types of violations is to sue the body in the circuit court. And frankly, when the public learns that, they get pretty incredulous. They don't think it's right that they should have to come up with the money to retain an attorney and so forth to file a lawsuit against a public body who has violated the law. But nonetheless, we do have the jurisdiction limited only to executive sessions, which articulates the purposes for which a governing body of a public body may hold a non-public or closed meeting.
Of course, that may or may not get a hearing in today's four-day-a-week circuit courts.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Agency staffing, Mr. Chair, has been reduced in the last 10 years. In the 1991-93 biennium, our approved staffing was 6.25 full-time equivalents. It has been at 4.0 full-time equivalents since 1997. We are currently, as I indicated earlier, at 2.4 for the remainder of this biennium. And the governor's balanced budget request is for 3.0 for the 2003-05 biennium.
As I look at that budget array, Mr. Hearn, and I look back at 1991-93, nearly $800,000 budget with 6.25. I look at the 99-01, nearly an $800,000 budget at that point with 4.0. Is that just a factor of labor over that period of time?
Mr. Chair, it has virtually very little to do with labor. Most of that fluctuation is due to attorney general costs for unanticipated contested cases and so forth, which we did have in the 91-93 biennium and in the 99-01 biennium. But in the intervening bienniums, it's less because we didn't have those costs. If my memory serves me correctly, we didn't have to approach the emergency board for those unanticipated costs between 94 and 98 or 99.
Okay. So you had sufficient in your budget or didn't have the unanticipated costs come up during that period of time?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, we prepared some exhibits which are included in the packet that I gave you. I just want to briefly go over and mention what they are. One of the reasons we wanted to do this was because we weren't sure that it was clearly known what the variety and breadth of the commission's responsibilities are. And so we just wanted to be able to depict that a little bit. The first things are exhibits A and B are the organizational charts. Basically, they're the same, except they show the reduced investigator position for 0305.
Let me just make sure we know where that's
in
at.
23.
Page 23.
Well, actually,
or in the handout, Mr. Chair.
I am referring to the handout, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry.
Okay, there it is right here, I'm sure.
Excuse me. That's fine, Mr. Chair. And then about four pages down, there's a little index of exhibits.
Okay.
We have our organizational charts. Prioritized list of services is Exhibit C, and I think that reflects what we've indicated as our primary goal of educating and preventing violations, that is responding to informal-related telephonic requests for information, or now a lot of email requests for information, providing the training presentations and issuing written advisory opinions, both informal and formal.
And it's the board's decision as to where the presentations, the training presentations, are made.
Mr. Chair, no, I make those decisions,
okay.
Those determinations. And then the next chart does reflect our educational presentations for the last 5 years. Shows the number per year, the total audience that's, and these are estimates, but I'm reasonably certain they're within 10% of being right on the nose, and the average size of our audiences. So we're doing an average of 54 a year, which is slightly more than one a week. And it's actually not we're doing them, Mr. Chair, I'm doing them. And sometimes if we're going to remote parts of the state, training for one day can mean 2.5 or 3 days out of the office. And
where is the most remote you've done training in, Mr. Hearn?
Oh, Mr. Chair, your neck of the woods.
You've actually been out to Malheur County?
I've been to Malheur County. My brother lives in Ontario.
So oh, okay.
I'm familiar with it. Oh, yes, sir. But no, Curry County several times, Jackson County several times, Clatsop County.
Takes a heck of a good meeting to get 50 people together in Malheur County, I'll tell you that.
It does. It does.
Got to have refreshments. Better be beef.
Mr. Chair, Exhibit E indicates the number of reports filed during the last 5 years, starting with the Statement of Economic Interest, lobbyist expenditure reports, lobbyist entity expenditure reports, and then we just indicate the number of lobbyists registered and the number of lobbyist entities registered on July 1st. And I just want to point out, you'll see a fluctuation here. As an example, 1998, you have 823, 99, 847. And basically, what we've seen happen is that there's a slight rise or a slight spike and a slight fall depending on the proximity to a legislative session year in the number of lobbyists. Oftentimes, we'll see the registrations increase mid-year prior to the session year, so in the even year prior, and then those are good for 2 years. Those expire, and then they go down again somewhat before the second session starts up. But it really does hold pretty steady.
And that registration for lobbyists is at no charge based upon the Supreme Court case?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. And Statement of Economic Interests, those are due April 15th, I believe. Is that
yes,
right?
Mr. Chair, and we'll be mailing those out to you next week.
Perfect. And you'll get yours at your home, and I'll get mine in Ontario, and I'll have to have it retransmitted. Is that available to us over the Internet by any chance?
Mr. Chair, it is not, but we can sure get it to you.
Well, I appreciate that. I guess my concern is it might be... It's an awful difficult thing to fill out, too. Have you ever looked into interactivity on that? Interactive...
On the net?
On the net.
Mr. Chair, we've looked at the concept, but frankly, just never had the resources to pursue it.
And Mr. Chair, I might note that one of the measures that's in the Senate General Government Committee, I believe, does have a concept in there that the commission would make that available. But as Mr. Hearn says, it is a resource issue.
Well, it's amazing, amazing to see that statements of economic interest, and those are for elected officials, aren't they?
Mr. Chair, thanks for asking that. I did want to clarify that. They're for the all statewide elected officials, the members of the Legislative Assembly, designated state agency heads, and then all elected city and county officials, all city and county planning commissioners, and all school district superintendents and business managers. Except it excludes six counties in northeastern Oregon. Oh, state board and commission members as well. But there's six of your northeastern counties that there was a provision back in 1974 when that measure was on the ballot that said if a majority of the voters in a respective city or county did not vote in favor, then they wouldn't be required to file this.
I see. So in northeastern Oregon, they've got some county officials that don't have to file or city officials?
That's correct.
I see.
Another example, sir, Mr. Chair, would be the city of Kaiser, which wasn't even a city when this passed. They don't have to file either. A city can do it by voting within their own city to do it, putting it out to their voters. And that has happened a time or two. The city of Yahats some years back did that.
And passed it?
Yes, sir.
So when we see it at a high over the past 5 years of 4,140 and a low of 3,807, a swing of about 300, which is about an 8% swing, are they just not filing the reports?
Mr. Chair, thanks for asking. No, that reflects election year swings when candidates for certain offices also have to file them.
Oh, I see. Okay. And these are kept alphabetically somewhere in your office?
Mr. Chair, they're not kept alphabetically. They're kept by jurisdiction and then alphabetically. For instance, we have, you know, for the year 2002, we have the members of the House of Representatives in one folder.
I see. And accessible by the public in normal business hours.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And then if they take copies, then they pay for the copies in your office?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And the same with the lobbyist reports. Again, you'd indicated that those go by election years pretty much. Is that right?
Oh, by legislative session years.
Legislative session, rather. So that a variation of 1,098 up to 1,779 would be election year versus not. I see lobbyist reports 2001, 1,798, and 2002, 1,098. That's a swing of 700 in that particular year. That would be reflective of the session in 2001, I guess.
I think, Mr. Chair, yes, but I also think it's reflective of a clearer understanding of who is and who isn't required to file as a lobbyist. Back in 1998-99, the Attorney General issued an opinion that clarified a lot of questions. As an example, the law does not require someone to register as a lobbyist if their lobbying activity is confined to giving registered public testimony before legislative committees. So someone could come in here and sit 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, and give testimony an hour a day, and as long as that's all they confined their activity to, they wouldn't have to register as a lobbyist. But people didn't understand that, and they were concerned, they were being overly cautious, and so they would register when they really didn't need to. And I think that the reduction in that number reflects that.
And if there's no charge, there would certainly be no reason not to be cautious at that particular point and register.
Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay.
Exhibit F, Mr. Chair, reflects some statistics about the outcome of our cases. And I'm very candidly, I've read in recent years public officials being quoted in the media saying that the commission is out to get people, or the commission is out to get me, and I think these numbers speak pretty clearly. As an example, we'll go to the first column, the calendar year 1998, in the third space down, which is ethics cases, 53 complaints open. Of the 53 complaints open, 32 were dismissed. Violation was only found in 21, and of the 21 in which the violation was found, there were only 12 that ended up in the imposition of penalties. And those numbers stay pretty consistent in that proportion through the years. We have noted in the last two calendar years a decline in the number of executive session cases, alleged violation of the executive session provisions. I have no explanation for that. I don't know why those have fallen off. There's certainly some theories we could speculate on, one being that education is paying off and the word has gotten out what is correct to do and what is not correct to do. I think perhaps another one might be apathy, that people just don't want to bother bringing it to our attention. But I have no way. That's pure speculation. But I wanted to bring these to your attention to see that I think this commission is, in fact, even-handed. You know, alternative dispute resolution is often mentioned, especially when someone sees us, a news headline about a case with this commission in court. Remembering how broad our jurisdiction is, the majority of the commission's involvement occurs at the local level. 99.9% occurs at the local level. But that doesn't garner the newspaper headlines that the fraction of cases that involve higher level officials do. But nonetheless, we successfully negotiate settlements or mediate successful dispositions in more than 90% of our cases over the five-year period. And then, Mr. Chair, the last exhibit, and I'm not going to go through it, I went ahead and answered the questions that you said agencies should be prepared to respond to.
Great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Any questions, Mr. Hearn? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Dave? Senator Winter?
Have you reviewed any of the other 31 states enabling legislation to determine whether there's some language that existed in theirs that didn't exist in ours to get around the ACLU issue?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, no, I haven't, and the reason simply is because of the language of the Oregon Constitution, and until that, and unless that's changed, I don't think we can do anything.
And Mr. Chair, if I might, and also
please,
Senator
Adrian.
Winters, we've looked at the concept, or we've talked about how could the commission be otherwise funded in order to maintain its relative independence and still be able to function viably. I do have, and I did talk with the National Council of State Legislatures and obtained a copy of a state-to-state report. However, because of the variation in the statutory implementation of agencies and the range of jurisdictions that the ethics agencies have amongst the various states, and their core constitutional language, and their court system, and the philosophies of the bodies of their courts, I haven't been able to draw any conclusion as to whether even statutory language might be able to mitigate some of the constitutional issues. And unfortunately, we had a rather busy interim. I posed the question to our legislative council as well, as that if to Ted Reutlinger, to see if he had an opportunity to perhaps examine it, and he did not because of the busyness of the interim. So we've had the idea that perhaps there could be some statutory or constitutional change that might be able to mitigate that, but again, haven't had drawn any conclusions on it. As the report from National Council of State Legislatures points out, that there are, and as Mr. Hearn indicated, many states that do charge lobby registration. I looked at some of the constitutional language in some of those states, and they all appear to have similar language to Oregon in terms of that no law shall be enacted to impair or infringe on the right to free speech. So it may simply have been a matter of how our court interpreted it.
Mr. Chair, just and Senator Winters, I did look, and this survey I got, I'd be happy to provide it to you if you're interested, but it appears as though the average fee charged is $100 per lobbyist client per year. So if I'm a contract lobbyist with 10 clients, it's going to be $1,000 a year. That was a pretty common rate. Some others were just $100 per lobbyist per year, period. But there were several that had that client factor.
Is that responsive?
I prize that because on the one hand, the agency is incurring expenses and providing its service without the benefit of having to have access to, as we call it, the other funds because of the court decision that clearly talked about freedom of speech. And I just wondered if there wasn't I'm always looking for ways of getting things done, but even with the court having the last say.
As I've gone over the Exhibit G questions, number 10, what items of court reform would be necessary to create meaningful savings within the department? Agency has not been involved in tort litigation for the past 12 plus years. However, other litigation related to reforms that could save the state possibly hundreds of thousands of dollars biannually would be to repeal a provision that permits respondents to require the agency to sue them in circuit court and to repeal the provision for payment of attorney fees to the prevailing party. The provision presently says that it must go to circuit court mandatorily, no provision for mediation.
Mr. Chair, what the provision does is it provides the respondent public official the option of requiring the commission to sue him in the Marion County Circuit Court.
I see. So that the nexus is all local for the commission at that point.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
I don't think that based upon the finger that I throw in the air to see what the temperature is, repealing the provision for payment of the attorney's fees for prevailing party is going to be overthrown right away. I mean, that's been a way to keep the state honest at the same time, to make sure that we're not aggressively pursuing cases that have no end other than just to pay back the attorneys.
But, in other suits, I don't think they like to lose a payer's prevailing issue. It's kind of interesting.
I
was setting note of that today because I was...
Yeah,
about another situation where
Senator, it would be wonderful to have, as opposed to the lawsuits that are filed for a 37-cent stamp.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be wonderful to have cases that have merit. Make sure that the prevailing party is awarded their attorney fees, and I think that. We might actually have some economic development going on in the state and some lumber being sold and those kinds of things out of the timber in our forest. The amount on line 13, approximately $45,000, is for payment to other state agencies. I assume that's to the Department of Administrative Services?
Mr. Chair, primarily, yes.
Okay. Any other service charge besides, I guess you've got your Attorney General fees. That would be... No other state agency that you have to respond to or pay payments to?
Mr. Chair, no.
Okay. And dues of $400, that's the annual dues for your Council on Government Ethics?
Mr. Chair, it's biennial.
Biennial. And when going back to Senator Winter's question, when you meet with those folks and find out that, or receive information from them, finding out what they do with regard to lobbying activities and how they charge lobbyists, have they tried to provide you any suggestions in that process of how they've done what they've done that might give us leeway to do the same in Oregon?
Mr. Chair, no.
Okay. And let's see. Director has attended only two such meetings during the past 12 months because of the budgetary constraints. So you do attend their national meetings?
Well, 12 years, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, over the past 12 years. Beg your pardon, you're absolutely right. Where are those meetings held?
Well, Mr. Chair, they're held in a variety of places. Toronto, Montreal, Vancouver, British Columbia, Philadelphia, Seattle.
The two that you've attended were in?
One was in South Carolina and one was in Philadelphia.
And the question as to a reduction one day a week would end up paying 20% less staff charges and 20% less accessibility to the public officials, lobbyists, and the public at large.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. In fact, that's where we are right now.
Since March 3rd?
Since November 1. Okay. I'm sorry, March 1 is correct.
Okay. Tell me if there appears to be a big backup of workload since March 1. Do you feel anything as you're kicking the doors open on the first day of the next week?
Mr. Chair, we get a buildup of voicemails from the day that we're gone. But as far as an impact on caseload, we're not going to see crisis arise simply because the commission is using its discretion, and we're not opening cases that we would have opened at another time. I mean,
okay.
if it's a less egregious matter, we simply call them on the phone and send them a letter and explain the circumstances and tell them we just don't have the resources to pursue it at this time.
That couldn't be very popular.
Well, that, Mr. Chair, that could be popular for some, but it also could be problematic if there is really the need to pursue the case.
Mr. Chair, if I could address that, please, Senator Winters. The Commission has begun a much more rigorous examination in the initial phase of whether or not to pursue anything, and I think there will be some people who feel that a violation has occurred who will be disappointed. I think there'll be some people who are potentially to be called on the carpet who will feel relieved that the violation appears at face value to be minor and therefore not worth pursuing. The Commission, despite the limited resources, has every intention of following up on significant violations that come before us. It was in the paper either yesterday or today that a sheriff in Central Oregon, or ex-sheriff in Central Oregon, was just sentenced to jail time for major embezzlement of funds. That case may or may not something we address. I don't want to be specific about it, but that was a major case.
I think we had a similar case with a school employee in Mount Hare County not that long ago that had been sentenced, actually had pled, and I think the Ethics Commission had decided that probably wasn't going to pursue it at that point. I don't know.
And Mr. Chair, on that, it's important to note that the statute, if there are criminal charges involved, the statute asks the Commission to step back and wait for that process, and we do. That sometimes leads to charges of piling on after the fact. That's how we are directed to function. And someone who embezzles has, in fact, violated criminal law, but also has violated the ethics law as well for converting public resources to private benefit.
Mr.
Senator Winters?
Chair, thank you. You know, I'm
think it's nice and well that there's some review at the front end to make sure that you're calling out those frivolous cases. But I was just sitting here thinking that when the commission was created and all of the discussions surrounding it, and it had to do with, you know, not only ethics, but to talk about public trust. And, you know, I was thinking that currently that the atmosphere out in our community, it doesn't have, isn't high on public trust right now. And, you know, here at a time when we're talking about, you know, kind of reducing your role and function, and yet that public trust issue still looms out there in the citizenry. Just my observation. I think that on the one hand, you have a small agency who is doing and trying to meet the statutory requirements of what this body has placed them in, and on the other hand, because of budgetary constraints, they're really somewhat restricted.
I'll be meeting today. Thank you, Senator Winters. I'll be meeting today with the co-chairs a little bit later on. We're all going to be called on the carpet to find out what it is that we're supposed to be doing. But as a part and parcel of what I'm supposed to be doing in this committee is to assist the members of the committee to find minimum amounts of efficiencies in general fund. Excuse me, this is an agency which is driven by general funds. It's an agency that has already appeared to have taken some cutbacks. I am anxious to take a look at the information which you provided relative to the mission statement, and then I would like to, somewhere in our documents here, I'm sure it's here, there's a 10% and a 30% cuts.
Perhaps, Mr. Chair, this would be a good time for Lori Byerly to
jump in and give her presentation. Lori?
Good morning, Chair Bella, members of the
Excuse me, just for a moment. Carl, were you going to participate other than just be here with us? I didn't want to cut you out before.
Chair, I appreciate that. All I have to add is my appreciation of and respect for the process.
Thank you very much, Carl. Appreciate it. Thanks for being here today, too.
Good morning, Chair Butler, members of the subcommittee. For the record, I'm Lori Byerly from the Department of Administrative Services Budget and Management Division. I'm the analyst for the Government Standards and Practices Commission. Before you, there's a packet that looks like this, and that's what I'll be referring to as I give my brief presentation on the agency. If you'll turn to page 2 of the packet, you'll see a budget comparison that shows kind of the history of the agency from 9901 actual up through the governor's 2003-05 budget. The columns on the right will show you that the agency has, over this period of time, taken reductions. The difference between the budget as it is currently and the 9901 the close of session figure is about a 23% decrease. So
let me just ask this with regard to 9901. Lori.
The comparison, Chair Butler, the comparison is between 2001-03 close of session, where it started and where it is now is about a 23% decrease.
And as we go back to the 9901 information, the 762,000 general fund, I think it was said earlier by Mr. Herneth, and you agreed that did not include any of these extraordinary costs that for prevailing parties.
Chair Butler, members of the subcommittee, there were some extraordinary costs in 1999-2001, and that is reflected in the $769,000 figure on there.
We probably need just a little bit better feel for that. What the extraordinary costs separated out would be, so that we can. It really doesn't give. I mean, 23% reduction looks like you're cutting this to the bones. When in effect, it appears that several hundred thousand dollars, at least $270,000 of the cost of the nearly $800,000. Was prevailing fee.
Chair Butler, the 23% we're talking about is from the close of session figure. This is this is the figure they started the biennium with, which did not include provisions for extraordinary costs. So the difference is between that number and what's in the 2003-05 governor's budget.
Well, I'm
Neither of those numbers have provisions for extraordinary costs.
Yeah, I was looking at the through fifth special session, the 23% reduction, which would have included those, wouldn't they? Yeah, through fifth special session includes the extraordinary cost. So the 23% cut but you're right. If you look at close of session versus the governor's budget, that's without any of the extraordinary costs.
Yes.
And that's a 4% reduction.
You're wondering about the in-between.
Yeah, I'm trying to go back.
Maybe what we could provide you that would be helpful is these same figures broken out, like you said, between what is this base budget amount versus what's in this amount that's extraordinary, so you can kind of see the two differences. And that's easy to do.
Thank you.
And you'll note, too, that between the 2103 beginning or starting number, closed session number, and the governor's budget, it does show the decrease in full-time equivalency from 4 to 3. On page 3 of the handout, this is the same information Adrian provided you earlier. It shows that, yes, indeed, the budget is primarily general fund at 99%. Page 4 of the handout is just a brief, some brief points about the Government Standards and Practices Commission budget for 2003-05. As we just talked about, it is a 23% decrease from the 2001-03 legislatively approved budget. And we just discussed that percent decrease does speak to some additional costs that were added to the agency's budget or dollars that were included as part of adjustments throughout the 2001-03 biennium. The budget carries forward, to some extent, $55,000 in general fund reductions made during the 2002 special session, and in a minute I'll discuss what I mean by that to some extent piece. The budget supports a minimum level of services and decreases staffing for the agency by 1/4. On page 5, you'll see the split between budget categories for the department. You'll see that 69% of the department's or agency's cost is in the personal services side.
Lori, somewhere in our binder, that $191,000 is broken out. Can you tell me where that's at in the binder?
If you look in the budget binder.
Yes, ma'am. Under special report.
Your back section. Mm-hmm. Starting on page 85, budget page 85 on the very back end of reports, you'll see the beginning of that midway through the page, the beginning of the breakout for services and supplies expenditures. And under the 2003-05 Governor's Balanced Budget column, you'll see there's a portion for in-state travel, nothing for employee training, about $7,500 for office expenses. And following on to the next page, you can see the breakout by category.
Tell me this with regard, excuse me for keep interrupting you here, Lori, but I just need to know, when I drop the staff from 6 down to a staff of 3, do I still have the same amount of facilities rental?
Chair Butler, member of the subcommittee, the cost reductions by dropping the full-time equivalency did not drive any direct impact on services and supplies. Right now, the way the 3.0 full-time equivalency is constructed, it's still really 4 people because the investigator function is 2 half-time functions. So there's still the same amount of bodies. The agency still has the same office space. It has a need for space for, aside from people, as for well as of storage of the statements of economic interest. It's got a pretty good rental lease rate on the space it has now, so there was no adjustment made for that. The cost primarily has been taken on the personal services side.
So back when we had 6 employees a number of years ago, 6 1/4 employees, we had a greater space in which to put those employees. Today we have 4 employees, but 2 of them working half-time. Is that correct?
Sure, Butler, I'll let Pat address that question if you need a better discussion.
Mr. Chair, our approved full-time equivalency was 6.25. We never had more than 5 bodies during that period.
And those 5 bodies that you had during that time are in the same space where there's 4 bodies today with 3 FTE.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. We have 1 empty desk where we are now.
Okay. Senator Winters.
Mr. Chair, just to ask a question, since it talks about rental, what's the length of your rental agreement?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, it's a renewable, I believe, 2-year. I think it was renewed in 2001. in the fall of 2001, so it would be up again this coming fall.
And you're currently you're not in a public building, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, no, we're not. We're in a private building over here at State and High Street. As was indicated, however, our rent really is very low on a square footage basis. And, Mr. Chair, while we're on this subject, if I may, I've contemplated this, and especially looking at the governor's balanced budget request of the 3.0. And there's no doubt that with three bodies versus five bodies, we could use less square footage. However, I'd be real concerned about how that would all wash out by the time you did the actual costs of moving, the costs of hooking up new computer cabling and new telephones and so forth. I'm not sure we'd really save very much, if anything.
Okay, I think it's a valid point. Senator Devlin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one general question, and this is not specifically relative to your current lease situation, but does the Department of Administrative Services look at fully at utilization of all state-owned facilities, and when you have an agency that is as small as this, whether or not that there is space available? We may actually be eliminating some things that are in some state office buildings that may end up creating space being available.
Senator Devlin, Chair Butler, it's my understanding that as agencies adjust to new staffing levels, especially in the 2003-05 biennium, that the Department of Administrative Services will be looking to maximize the use of available state office space. I know it is concerned. I'm not sure if specifically the Department of Administrative Services Facilities Division has looked at government standard space is aware that that's something they could stick somewhere. I could look into that for you and get some verification. But I know that part of this downsizing process will be to try and maximize the use of the state space as much as possible.
Chairman, follow up.
Yes, please follow up.
In that particular case, it would seem reasonably prudent that where you had leases that might be expiring, that you looked at alternatives before you renewed the lease, and we didn't end up with state office buildings with vacant space while we were leasing.
Chair Butler, Senator Devlin, that's true, that we want to make sure that as those lease comes up for renewal, that's part of the process to identify whether or not the lease should continue.
And I think the concern there was that just if you did swap around, that it's going to be an expensive, going to have some expenses in that process. But I would leave that to the folks at budget management to make sure that that analysis is done, how much it's going to cost to move from one space to another. Senator Winters?
I was just going to add that, because there's several factors in it. One is the cost of moving, and two, in not all situations, is the cost of the private space. The state space does not necessarily have to be lower per square footage than the other spaces. So I think all that analysis has to be made when you're considering swapping space.
Thank you. Lori, I had interrupted you right where you were talking about other costs and employee costs.
Chair Butler, but I just want to take another look back on page 86 of the budget support document, just to briefly go down that list of services and supplies expenditures. You'll see that $45,000 is budgeted for state government service charges, as Pat discussed earlier. Primarily, that's Department Administrative Services work that the department receives benefit from. As part of the 2003-05 continued budget process, I believe that figure will likely come down as we see reductions in other areas. So that has not been adjusted yet for any changes in the Department Administrative Services or other entities that receive some of those charges. You'll see minor expenditures for data processing, publications, some dollars for professional services, and then you'll see that a large portion of the agency's service supply dollars is for attorney general expenditures, about $66,000.
Down, that $66,000 I noticed is down from the 9901 actual.
Yes, Chair Butler, the 9901 actuals would have included what actually was spent, which included some of those extraordinary expenses in there. That's why it's lower, is those were part of what actually was spent, whereas the new number is bringing it back down to the, kind of base level.
Then the 0103 estimates at $70,000, why wouldn't that include, or did that include the additional costs that we incurred in the three that we had to pay the prevailing party?
Chair Butler, members of the subcommittee, that 0103 estimate column would have at the time of budget development, captured what the agency thought they were going to expend. Actually, since that time, that number is higher.
Okay.
And I think I should also clarify, too, that the prevailing party fees were not paid through the Attorney General line.
Oh, no, but right. The Attorney General's cost to have litigated
for those
cases
yes,
would have been there.
Chair Butler, yes, there is associated cost for that. If you look on the line above, if you were to go back to the 2103 estimates, you'll see a $136,000 figure. That relates to prevailing party fees.
As I look at that, though, relative to the fact that there were some cases in process in the 0103 with a $70,000 estimate at that time, $66,000 in the governor's recommended budget right now is still a fairly healthy litigation opportunity. I mean, it's not a severe cutback, it doesn't appear.
Chair Butler, members of the subcommittee, as part of the budget development process, when the agency came forward to the emergency board, I believe back in April, part of the discussion was around, there was a need for some base Attorney General expenditures. I mean, there, aside from extraordinary costs continuing to be incurred, there was also an underlying deficit.
We have some of our unscheduled bans, or unscheduled, didn't we, at that point? Didn't we unschedule some attorney fees?
That was in November.
If you'll go back to Adrian's document real quickly, if you want to pick up that last page,
right.
Maybe we could take
Item 17, November. $30,000 unscheduled Attorney General's costs. And that isn't included in the 0103 estimates then.
Chair Butler, you're correct. That November 2002 emergency board item is not in the budget figures anywhere because that's past budget development time. It's not reflected in any place in the 0305 budget. If you look back to that April 2002 item that was discussed, the last paragraph, this request included amounts for a direct shortfall of $42,000 for prevailing party costs and $40,000 to establish a base level of funding for Attorney General charges for remainder of the biennium. This base level was retained for the 2003-05 governor's budget because aside from the extraordinary issues, there was also an underlying shortfall just in that base. We need the AG to handle our essential case functions, work with us on issues, review cases. So that's why there's a little bit higher level built into that 2003-05 number. So back on page 86, I think we had covered the Attorney General fees. And then walking on down, you'll see a little bit of money for employee recruitment, dues and subscriptions. And then on page 87, you'll see that the department is budgeted to spend about $40,000 in rent for the course of the 0305 budget.
Why would you have any recruitment costs in this year?
Highly unlikely, Chair Bell.
Yes. All right. Thank you.
Does that kind of help talk about the services?
Certainly, thank you. We can proceed.
So, Chair Butler, members of the subcommittee, if we go back to the documents I had handed out, the slides, page 6 starts kind of a walkthrough of the development of the governor's budget for 2003-05. We began with, as part of the budget development process, the 2003 legislatively adopted budget, which was 650,000 total funds. Took some actions that had occurred over the course of the 2103 biennium, including actions taken at the 2002 emergency board. The emergency board included approved $102,000 general fund for extraordinary legal expenditures and attorney general costs. And as I had just said previously, a portion of this related to some base underfunding for attorney general, about $40,000 of that amount. House Bill 5575, passed during the second special session, took away $12,000 general fund related to reduced Secretary of State charges and some unspecified cuts. The agency has handled these unspecified cuts with reducing personal services expenditures. House Bill 5091, third special session, added some dollars, about $18,000 general fund for employee salary adjustments. This is part of the salary pot distribution that was made to all state agencies as part of that action. At the same time, the bill took away another $12,800 general fund for unspecified reductions. So the agency actually got a net increase of about $5,000 through that action. Once again, the agency addressed those unspecified reductions through reducing personal services expenditures, primarily in the area of investigations. Base budget adjustments relating to the roll-up of 2103 position actions and compensation changes. As you're aware, within the agency budgets, adjustments were not made to take out merit increases for 2001-03, and that will be an adjustment that we'll be looking at. I have a feeling, I think maybe everyone and the commission is close to the top step, so it may not be real relevant in terms of having an impact on personal services expenditures for the agency in 0103 or 0305, but that will be adjusted as we move through the work session. On page 7, essential packages. Package 010 took some non-PIX personal services adjustments, including an increase in mass transit tax. And
how much was that increase?
For mass transit, mm-hmm. 242.
What's the percentage, do you know?
Percentage for mass transit? 0.006, I believe, Senator Winters.
That's for Salem?
That's for Salem. I believe that's a statewide percentage, Senator Winters, Chair Butler, for all the mass transit districts.
Okay.
Well, Senator? Isn't there what, Salem, Portland, and what's Lane County?
Lane County, and Senator Winters, Chair Butler, I believe there's a new transit district over on the coast as well.
Okay. Sorry.
Moving on to the second essential package, package 020, program adjustments. What this package did was phase out a big portion of those extraordinary costs that the agency had incurred during 0103. That amounted to $155,000 in extraordinary attorney general costs and one-time expenditures for prevailing party fees. Package 030 includes inflation for state government service charges as well as other service supply categories. Like I said before, that's an area that will likely have some adjustments made to it. On page 8, policy packages in the 2003-05 Governor's Budget for Government Standards and Practice Commission. Package 070 was a revenue shortfall package. As Adrienne mentioned in her presentation, the department had a figure in there of about $10,000 for the biennium and other funds revenue based on copying and sending out documents. That revenue is not materializing primarily because individuals have been accessing the Internet. So we adjusted that other funds revenue and expenditure piece down to a more realistic level. So we didn't want to budget that if the revenues weren't going to materialize. So that package decreased that down to about $4,200 in expenditures and revenue. Package 081 relates to actions taken during the 2002 third special session. As part of the philosophy behind building the 2003-05 governor's budget, we took forward actions that had occurred during 2001-03 and rolled those forward to try and find savings in 03-05. This rolled forward the reduction in investigator staffing for a decrease of $136,000. Package 020 rolled forward actions that were taking, sorry, Package 082 rolled forward actions that had been taken during the 2002 fifth special session for reductions amounting to $180,000. This pretty much would eliminate the entire investigative capacity and decrease the agency supports position by one-fourth, essentially leaving the agency with the director and part of a support staff person to operate and support the commission. With recognition that this was probably a level of support that was not going to help the agency perform its mission or in reality be able to function, in Package 092, a portion of that was restored. We added back funding to sustain a basic level of agency services, which leaves the agency with three full-time equivalencies, the director, administrative support, and one full-time equivalency in investigator capacity. Right now that capacity is split between two individuals and two positions, but it's essentially one full-time equivalency worth of work for that effort. So that's kind of where the governor's budget was left, three full-time equivalency, kind of some philosophy in letting the agency sort of maintain base level of services and still be able to perform the functions it's currently doing now. As Dave said, maybe not investigating some of the things they would have before, but still able to address some of the cases that come forward to the commission from the public.
Other questions, Ms. Barley? Thank you very much, Lori. Again, in conclusion of what I was mentioning a few moments ago, we'll be meeting with our co-chairs relative to other kinds of efficiencies that are going to be expected of general government. One of the reduction packages, we will want to take a look at a 30% priority here, and then the 10% reduction. What is that, 3182? Is that hospital 3182? Mm-hmm. Is that somewhere here? Did I miss that as I was going through? Jump back to the back of the binder. It must be up towards the front. 3182 is on page 29, 31. And then we need to compare that with the actual mission statement of the priorities. But we will be responsible to find some efficiencies and general funds agencies, and we'll just have to get back after we've had an opportunity to meet with our leadership in the House and the Senate, our various caucuses. Any questions?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Hearn?
If I may make one final comment, sir.
Please.
I certainly appreciate and understand your requirement and need to find some more efficiencies and increase available general fund revenues. I would point out a couple of things. The agency's gone from 6.25 10 years ago to 3, and very honestly, the reason for that is that we've optimized efficiencies. Not only have we optimized efficiencies, we have a clerical support person who can do the job of about 3 people. We were very lucky and still are to have that person. But, Mr. Chair, the governor's balanced budget is pure, honest-to-gosh minimum in order for the agency to maintain any kind of viable functionality. And I would be the first to sit here and say that if it is not possible, if fiscal constraints prevent the Legislative Assembly from approving that requested budget, then I would be the first to suggest that you completely unfund the agency and use that money to buy a state trooper or a teacher or both.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hearn. I think the concern that we have, and I think you've seen the list that was provided to us by the Senate and House leadership when we got into the budgetary process, and that it's a list of the criteria, and amongst those things is, does it save lives, and does it provide for the public safety, and does it in effect make sure that the children are in the front of the line, as the governor has asked us to make sure. And I appreciate that offer and that expression. There are grave concerns when we are seeing total agencies basically suspended for the next biennium with regard to some of the commissions and the advocacy groups. So we'll certainly take that under advisement. Thank you very much for that expression. If there are no other questions, then we will go ahead and stand adjourned until we do have a work session on this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.